Welcome to the Awaken Podcast. At Awaken Church, we are passionate about wrestling with and being unraveled by the Christian scriptures. Ideally, we do this together around the table in the neighborhood of Bowness. As we see it, Jesus has invited all of us to encounter him in a diverse community and participate with him in a mission of loving our neighbors.
So we're doing this new series. I'm really hopeful for it. It's called How and Why and For Whom to Read the Scriptures or Engage the Scriptures. And we're going to go in big chunks. And I just think a lot of people, especially Westerners, Western evangelicals, we need a new way of approaching the scriptures. We don't really know how, and a lot of people just have lost that interest, and that's okay. So one of my favorite things to do is just wear my heart on my sleeve and get really passionate about the text, because the text has been so life-giving for me, and I know that's one of the reasons I still get to do this over and over. So thank you for letting me just fall in love with the ancient stories in front of you, which I will do today, and I have no doubt that I will have to work very hard to contain some of the joy that the Pentateuch or the Torah gives to me. So this sermon is called The Nameless God, and it is about how to read the Torah. And so when you hear the word Torah, it's a very Jewish word, it's a very Hebrew word, and so I just want to plant this seed that will hopefully grow for the next 6 weeks, that there is a way that the Hebrews, some like ancient Jewish traditions of reading the Bible that are very different from the dominant Western way of reading the Bible. And I would say the traditional Jewish way is that you invite everyone over to your house and you have a big feast and there would be good food and good wine and you would have a passionate, fiery debate the whole evening. You'd slam your fists and say, but what about Deuteronomy 6? Well, what about Ephesians 2? Well, they might not quote Ephesians, but what about Proverbs 2? And then this passionate dialogue and wrestling. And at the end of the night, they would say, what a good night. What a good time that was. To talk, to fight, to argue, what love, what to wrestle, and kind of comes alive in that. But sometimes, and this has certainly been my experience in a lot of my traditions, the Western way of reading the Bible is to say, the Bible says it, I believe it, that settles it. Conversation over. As soon as someone at a family dinner says, well, what about the refugees? Then someone could quote a verse and shut the conversation down. And often the Western way has been like, either the Bible is an answer book or an instruction manual, and it ends the conversation. And so what I would love to see, and I know that awakeners are like already kind of there and at least longing for this, is this symbol of the table that's in the center of the room, is that dialogue, that wrestling, that engaging is much more life-giving and much more true to the original writers and readers' intent, okay? So I hope you have more questions at the end of this than answers. And then I hope that question burns on you and you come leaning in even closer. I hope it seduces you. I hope it allures you in to the wrestle, to the fight, to the nonviolent fight. And you know what a nonviolent fight is? A dialogue. It's a gift. And there's a story of a fight in the book of Genesis, and it's where the whole name Israel comes from. If we have time, let me see. We'll talk about that today. Okay, so check this out. When you read, so if I were to answer the first question, how to read the Torah, that's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, not passages people associate with being very interesting. The way that I would like to challenge Western readers to enter that part of the scripture is when you read it, look for which characters have power and which characters have no power. Which characters have privilege and which characters have access to no privilege? Which characters have a name and which characters are nameless? Okay, so in the Garden of Eden, which is where it all begins, it's like this beautiful vision of shalom. You have Adam and Eve, they're unashamed, they're partners. There's abundance, there's no fear, competition, scarcity, there's no like storing up in case there's not enough. It's just constant abundance and life and a sharing, a seeing each other fully and being seen fully. What a dream. But as they exit the garden and begin to pursue power, that's exactly what it is. So in the West, we think of sin in terms of like morality and behavior. But in the Hebrew, it's not about morality. It's about the pursuit of power. They get out of Eden and they build a tower and they want to become like the gods. And when the Tower of Babel thing doesn't work, they end up in Egypt, which is about build an empire. And then you have enslaved people with no name and no power building storehouses for the excess of the king. It's like the extreme opposite of Eden. And so just to remind you, between Eden and Egypt, you have stories of God constantly having to decide between the named and the nameless, or the powerful and the powerless. So the very first like murder story in the whole Pentateuch is Cain and Abel. And you have Cain as the firstborn son. The firstborn son in Hebrew culture, it's called primogeniture. The firstborn son gets the inheritance. He gets the blessing. He gets like the father's name often. He gets a double portion of everything. He's born into privilege, and the youngest son gets very little. Often the youngest son isn't even like counted. Like if you have eight sons, you don't even invite the eighth son to the event. That happens in the case of King David. So you have two brothers bring a sacrifice to God. And in the Torah, their sacrifices are exactly equal. I've heard some come kind of try and read this Christological reading into that story and say, well, Abel brought a lamb and Cain just brought grains and the lamb is better. But in the Torah, the grain and the lamb offering is exactly the highest two sacrifices. And God has to choose one, but he chooses the little brothers. He does not acknowledge the system that would privilege the firstborn son. He picks young Abel. And to be denied access to that privilege enrages Cain, and he murders his brother Abel. God pulls the thread of that power system, that power dynamic, and dismantles that system, and Cain is enraged and murders Abel. The next main characters in the story, you have very old, very barren Abraham and Sarah. They are old, they are childless, they are landless wanderers, and God says, these are the folks that I'm going to use to rescue the world. And Abraham and Sarah, all their promised land and lots of children, they never get land and they only get one child. They constantly face difficulty. They are never granted access to great power or influence. Their son Isaac marries a woman who herself is barren and unable to have children. It's only through a miracle that her womb is opened, and then she gives birth to two boys at one time, twins, Jacob and Esau. And the Jacob and Esau story, like, that is top shelf Bible story content right there. Esau is the firstborn, and not only is Esau the firstborn, he's hairy and he likes hunting. He's a man's man. Like, he fits perfectly the stereotype, like the dominant type of manliness. And Jacob is not loved by his father. He's only loved by his mother. He has smooth skin and he doesn't like hunting. He likes cooking. And Jacob prefers Esau, but Rebekah prefers Jacob. And eventually, because Jacob is going to be denied love and blessing and inheritance, he tricks his father. And God chooses Jacob. God chooses the brother that doesn't fit the mold. And you move on from that, Jacob falls in love with a woman who cannot have kids. Jacob ends up, I'm skipping a lot to kind of show you the way that God always chooses the youngest brother, always chooses the barren woman. He always chooses the powerless and the nameless characters. Jacob has 12 sons, and his favorite one is young Joseph. And the older brothers hate Joseph. Jacob gifts his son Joseph with like a jacket or a dress. The Hebrew word it's like a gown. And the older brothers bully him and hate him and beat him. They throw him away. They cast him off, sell him into slavery. Then he ends up in Egypt. So that's the book of Genesis, is God preferring the powerless, preferring the people without privilege. He's the God of the little brother. And now I just want to show you the way the book of Exodus begins, and we'll land there. I will read this to you. I would love, like, if you were going to read something from the Pentateuch this week, I would recommend the first 10 chapters of Exodus. The way Exodus chapter 1 begins is so incredible, and it sets the whole tone for the whole thing. Let me just show you. Okay, so it says this in Exodus chapter 1. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from our slavery." Therefore, they set cruel taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities and storehouses for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites and made their lives very bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks. Like the image the author here wants you to know, they were bad people. And there were very vulnerable people. They carried the burdens of the people with power. The king of Egypt then said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, "When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if they have a baby boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, she shall live." Now, here's what's so epic about that story is biblical scholars in like the 1800s, when like Western scholars were trying really hard to find the science, so like archaeology and source criticism and like did this historically happen or not was like the driving question to all of biblical studies, looked at this text and noticed that nowhere in the book of Exodus is the king of Egypt given a name. He's never named, it's just the Pharaoh of Egypt, and like there's lots of pharaohs of Egypt. It would really help us if we knew which one, because we could date it and then we could go to archaeology and find out if it actually happened. So they argued that the fact that the pharaoh's never named means the story never actually happened. It is not historically a true event. It's meant to just be a myth or like a legend. And then they kind of moved on. But fortunately, kind of the next generation of scholars said, "Well, hold on just a minute. The pharaoh is not named, but you're telling me the person that wrote this didn't know the name of the king of Egypt, but knew the name of the Hebrew midwife slave women, Shiphrah and Puah." So like the scene is like the king of Egypt, the most powerful empire in the world. Everybody in the known world has sold themselves in slavery to this man because he has all the money and all the power, and he has slaves building him sheds to store his excess wealth. And then you have so in that culture, if you're a midwife, it means you don't have children, like you would be a barren woman and you would help the other women give birth. So this is not the Hebrew woman midwife, like the fancy midwives for the rich ladies. This is the slave midwife who helps the slave women birth their children. You literally can't get lower than to be a Hebrew slave midwife. And the author in the book of Exodus makes sure you know their names. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah. It's very subtle. He doesn't think women are threats. He doesn't think slave women could be threats, but he's a little bit afraid of the boys. Boys could have power. Boys could rise up. Boys could build an army. If it's a boy, kill it, but let the girl live. What's a girl going to do? Dismantle the entire empire? Well, between Shiphrah, Puah, Yocheved and Miriam, that's exactly what happens. The king is never named, but the midwives are. And that's all you need to know about the book of Exodus. The people so everybody in the world knows the name of this king, but the author says, "I don't care about this character's name." But the characters who've never been named, you need to know who they are. And then only two chapters later, in Exodus chapter 3, Moses, who's now a fugitive, who's living his life in the hills, afraid of Egypt, encounters this burning bush, which freaks him out. He takes off his shoes, and he's like, "What is happening?" And the burning bush says, "I'm the God of your fathers, your ancestors." And Moses says to him, "What's your name?" So there's named midwives, there's an unnamed king, and there's a God who also doesn't have a name. Moses says, "What is your name? I don't know this God. Who are you?" Moses says in 3 verse 13, "If I come to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your ancestors has sent me to you,' they will say to me, 'What is his name? What do I tell them? I don't know your name.'" And then God reveals his name to Moses, "I am who I am," which in Hebrew is Yahweh. "This is my name." And sure enough, this is my favorite part. In Exodus chapter 5, Moses and Pharaoh, and they say, "The God of our ancestors has sent us to you. You must let my people go." This is exactly what he says. This is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says, let my people go. Pharaoh says, who is Yahweh? I have never met this God. I've never heard this name. I don't know who this God is. Who is Yahweh that I should obey him? I do not know Yahweh. Therefore, I will not let Israel go. Exodus 5, verse 2. And then you've seen Prince of Egypt, at least. You know how the story goes. Slowly, God introduces himself to Pharaoh. He takes out the Egyptian gods one by one through the plagues and the wonders, and eventually the nameless slaves walk through the Red Sea on dry ground. And the word in Exodus 14, God says, now you know my name. So let me read to you in the 8 verses in Exodus 14. Verse 10, it says, as Pharaoh drew near, the Israelites looked back, and there were the Egyptians advancing on them. So the Hebrew slaves are running out of Egypt, and they get to the shore of this huge body of water, and then the military, the Egyptian military, is pursuing them, and they're like, why did you bring us out here to die? Like, this is, we have no power. We don't know what to do. So it says, as Pharaoh drew near, the Israelites looked back, and there were the Egyptians advancing on them. In great fear, the Israelites cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you took us out here to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the very thing we told you would happen? Leave us alone. Let us be slaves to the Egyptians. It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than die here in the wilderness. But Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Stand firm and see the deliverance Yahweh will accomplish for you today. The Egyptians whom you see now, you shall never see again. Yahweh will fight for you. You only need to stand still. Then Yahweh said, why do you cry out to me? Tell the Israelites to go forward. Lift up your staff, stretch your hand over the sea, divide it. The Israelites will go through on dry ground. And the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh. When I have gained glory for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his chariot driver. And so this is how God says, now you know who I am. And when they walk through that dry ground, and they watch the Egyptian military, the strongest group of human beings alive at that time in the world, get swallowed up in that body of water, they break out in song and say, we will sing, and then they name their God to Yahweh. Horse and rider, he has thrown into the sea. The nameless people walk through the sea on dry ground. Shiphrah and Puah were there, and the king of the Egyptians is forgotten. Rendered nameless, rendered powerless. And then right after this, they end up at the base of Mount Sinai. And when God speaks to these people he just rescued, these people he just named, these people he just gave his name to, it says, then Moses went up to God, and Yahweh called to him from the mountain and said, this you shall say to the house of Jacob. You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you obey my voice, keep my covenants, you will be for me a treasured possession out of all the peoples. Indeed, the whole earth is mine, but you will be for me a holy nation, a priestly kingdom. And when he finally speaks the very first word of the Ten Commandments, a lot of people miss this. They think the Ten Commandments is like rules that keep you from having fun or something. But in Exodus 20, it says, then God spoke all these words. I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You will have no other gods but me. The nameless God, the God the Egyptians had never heard of, makes a covenant with a nameless people and says, you will be my treasured possession. You will not be like the other nations. You will never be like Egypt. You will never become like Pharaoh. You will be different. He is the God of the people who escape the house of Egypt. He's not the God of Egypt. And this idea, and people miss it, but they think the whole point of the book of Exodus is God announcing his name. He's giving his name to his people who have no name. He's naming the Hebrew midwives in saying, not only am I going to know your name, I will treasure you out of the empire. The story in Genesis 32 is Jacob, the guy who has no body hair, and he likes cooking, he doesn't like hunting, who's always had to like lie and steal and trick his way into anything. He wrestles with God in Genesis 32. He has a fight with God. And it's interesting because it's kind of an obscure, ambiguous passage, because he's fighting with a man, but this man is like God. This man's kind of confusing. Jacob doesn't know his name. And in Exodus 32, it says, as they were wrestling, Jacob overpowers this man. And then the man uses his power to dislocate Jacob's groin or hip and says, "Let me go." God says that to Jacob. It's really wild. "Let me go." And Jacob says, "Not until you bless me." And so the God blesses him by giving him a new name, the name Israel. And in this exchange, Jacob says to the man, "What is your name?" But the man remains nameless. He does not give his name to Jacob. And then after this happens, Jacob said, "I have seen the face of God and I did not die." So Jacob knows he was just given a new name. Your name will no longer be deceiver, trickster, thief, stealer. Your name will be Israel, which means fights with God. And he's never given his name. And so when God tells Moses his name, it's in there in Exodus 3. He says, "I've never given my name to anyone before, Moses. You're the first one ever that I'm going to tell my name to you." And Moses receives God's name, and the nameless slaves are given a name. And that's the point of Exodus. And so a lot of people think the Pentateuch is the law. It's the list of rules. And that's true, but it's important to understand that the list of rules functions in two ways. You see, the Pentateuch teaches that, how do I say this? Okay, back it up a little bit. God's people is a small band of powerless people, constantly under the threat of domination and genocide. They escape Egypt, and they will now try to create their own identity and like their own space to have their own culture and their own practices. But bigger, more powerful nations will constantly be a threat to them. And the Pentateuch teaches this, that God does indeed play favorites. He favors those who are favored by no one. And so the law functions in two ways. One, how to not be like the nations. How to not be like Egypt. Yes, you might get a power that you could have your own military and you could kill people, but you shall not kill. Yes, you might have enough power to see something you want and go take it, but you shall not steal. Yes, you might see an attractive woman and she's all by herself and she's vulnerable and her husband's out of town. Yes, you might have enough power to take her, but you shall not touch your neighbor's wife. You shall not touch your neighbor's daughter. You shall not do corrupt dealings with corrupt businesses. You will not become Pharaoh. Don't buy cotton from the Egyptians. There's some obscure passages in Exodus that don't make sense unless you understand this idea. Don't go buy cotton from the Egyptians. You might end up in debt to them and find yourself back in slavery. Or you might get very rich from them and find yourself looking into buying your own slaves. Don't buy pork from the Canaanites. Everything within you will want to go and secure power and control and build your own storehouses and get your own slaves and secure enough money and power and military strength as possible in order to like know what's going on in the world. But this law will keep you off of Pharaoh's throne. It will keep you out of Egypt. This law will keep you off the throne and away from the labor camps. Follow this law, though you may one day gain enough power and privilege to steal and kill and lie and force people into slavery. This law refuses to let you go and become like the nations. And the second thing the law does, and it's heartbreaking, but it's beautiful, is the law protects the memory of the people. The law protects their story, their identity. 16 times in the book of Deuteronomy alone, you have the command, remember. Remember. The other nations, the Egypts, the Canaans, the Babylons, the Assyrias, they're all going to want to come in and they're going to be so powerful and so attractive and so beautiful. You're going to want to go learn their language, practice their religion, buy their stuff, look like them. You're going to want to be like them. But remember, 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 the law isn't there to help you obtain moral purity It's not there to help you secure power and live a good life. It's there to help you resist power, stay connected to your community, to remain a blessing to your neighborhood, not a burden to your neighborhood, to keep you in the land. In Deuteronomy chapter 5 is the central command. When Jesus is asked what's the most important command, he quotes, Deuteronomy chapter 6. Listen to this. This is the remembering part of the whole Torah. Hear, O Israel, the Lord, Yahweh. Every time you see capital L-O-R-D, that's just code for Yahweh. The name of God is too holy to know the God's name that even the English translators obscure it with the word Lord. The Lord, Yahweh, is our God. Yahweh alone. You shall love Yahweh, your God, with your heart, with your soul, and with your might. Keep these words that I am commanding you today in your heart. Recite them to your children. Talk about them when you are at home and when you are away, when you lie down and when you wake up. Bind them as a sign on your hand. Fix them as an emblem on your forehead. Write them on the doorposts of your house. Write them on your gates. Remember this. Remember the God who gave you his name, the God that no one else in the world knew. Remember the one God that named you. If you forget this, it won't be long before you are either back in slavery where no one knows your name, or you will be on the throne rendering people nameless and forgetting the name of your God. And so in the next verse, it says, Yahweh did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than all the other peoples. He didn't choose you because you were more righteous or more obedient or more pure. He chose you because you were the least of the peoples. You were the least of these. It was because Yahweh, the Lord your God, loved you, that he kept the oath he swore to Abraham and Sarah, that he brought you out with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore that Yahweh, your God, is faithful, keeping his covenant of love to 1,000 generations. And the whole Pentateuch ends not very many chapters after that verse. I didn't choose you because you were big and powerful. Don't think you got to get big and powerful to get my love. And don't think that if you get big and powerful, it's because you have it. I chose you because you were the least of these. I am the God of the least of these. I am the unnamed God that prefers the unnamed people. And at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, Moses dies. Never stepping foot in the promised land, never tasting the milk and honey, and Moses' children are never counted at any genealogy. The Mosaic covenant, which we refer to every time we take communion, is made with truly the leader of the least of these, who himself was the least of these. And so, how do we read the Pentateuch? With an eye towards those in the text who have no power, who are loved by nobody, who are favored by nobody, with an eye towards the least of these. Who has the power between the fertile wife and the barren wife? The fertile wife. Notice which one gives birth to the chosen one. Why do we read it? Why should we do it? To remember that this story doesn't belong to the nation building walls to keep the immigrants out. It belongs to the nameless, unfavored, vulnerable people waiting outside of the wall. Why do we read it? Because Jesus says in Matthew 26, one day you will ask me, Jesus, where were you? And I will say, when I was in prison, you visited me. When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was sick, you took care of me. Whatever you did for the least of these, you did for me. Whatever you did to the people whose name you don't know, I am the nameless person in your neighborhood. I came home this week on Friday, like, kind of in this weird space, and David's like, what's going on? And I was like, I think Jesus is a Yazidi woman named Monifa. I was kind of not wanting to go hang out with the Yazidis on Friday because I was like, I'm tired. Haven't I given enough? Haven't I helped enough people this week, Lord? And I sat with this woman and her eyes lit up when she saw me. And I remembered God said, well, you haven't spent time with me yet. Maybe God, the unnamed God, who we know as Yahweh, Jesus, is there with the addicts. Maybe our God is a missing indigenous woman whom no one is looking for. And so why do we read it? We read the Pentateuch because Jesus, Emmanuel, God with us, incarnate God of the covenant, dies on a Roman cross, enters into the story of the shamed, the forgotten, the unloved. Jesus enters into the story of those kids kicked out of their house. And he invites us to pick up our cross and meet him there. And he says, though your mother may forget you, I will not forget you. I have your name etched on the palm of my hand. That's in Isaiah. And in Isaiah 43, there's this passage in conclusion, referring back to the whole Pentateuch. Isaiah, so Isaiah is based heavily on the book of Exodus, and Jeremiah is based entirely on Deuteronomy. So everything else you tug on in the entire Bible, you're going to pull Exodus and Deuteronomy into your lap when you tug on it. So it's very powerful. See if you hear it. In Isaiah 43, this is what the prophet says. But now thus says Yahweh, who created you, O Jacob, who formed you, O Israel, do not be afraid. I have redeemed you. I've called you by name. You are mine. You hear that? I called you by name. It's me. I know your name. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, they will not overwhelm you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. I am Yahweh, your God. I gave Egypt as your ransom, Ethiopia, Sidi, all these powerful nations, all these empires, all these colonial projects. I'd sell them just to buy you. You without a name, you without power. Everyone whom is called by my name, I created for my glory. I formed them and I made them. So the God of the Pentateuch is the namer of names. When you meet Jesus on the cross, you remember that God was never a Roman, an Egyptian, a Babylonian. He was there with the Hebrew slaves, Shipra and Pua. And so I'm going to pray, and then after that, I'm going to invite Anna to lead us in communion. And if you have any questions or you want to just talk about this or get clarification on this, I would love to have that dialogue with you. So when I'm done, if there's anything that's like immediately you want to say, which I feel like no one, that's so not awakened, but maybe we'll get there. And so I'll just give space for that. Otherwise, we'll get together and have coffee this week. So let me pray for you and then open up the mic. Namer of names, crucified God. Jesus, when walking on the road to Emmaus, it says in Luke that you opened up the scriptures for these young men who didn't even recognize you. You walked them through the Torah and the prophets to show them who you are. Jesus, we imagine that you told them about Shifra and Pua. Help us name and bless the unnamed and forgotten people living in Bowness and in Calgary. Help us to go to those places within ourselves where we know we have weakness, where we know we have no power and no control, where shame and anger dwell. Help us to name it. Thank you that you did not give your church the authority to judge sin, but that you gave your church the authority to forgive it and so to set the captives free. Turn our eyes towards the powerless. Trip us up in our own pursuit of power and control. Help us to remember you, to remember your vision for this community that would be known by your name. Help us teach it to the children, to remember it when we wake up and when we go to sleep, to remember it on our hand when we go to hurt people or help people or spend money or make money. Help us write it on the doorposts of our house, that we would not be people who build up storehouses, but we would be people who bust open the doors and invite the neighbors to the table. Invite us into the story and give us a role to play. Thank you, God. Amen. Amen. Something that I've been thinking about a lot recently is this idea that the Bible, that the scriptures could be a script which we are invited to act out together. Those of you who don't know me well, I am a performer, an actor. So if we lived in a normal time when we were allowed to do live performances, my job would be to act out scripts. And I was reminded of a lecture, a guest lecturer who came in and described an act of worship as a performance in which the worship leader is not the performer, but sort of a facilitator who leads the congregation in a performance that we put on together. So I was thinking about the way that communion is us performing together the scriptures, the script of the scriptures, that I'd share with you the process in my, as a performer, of performing a script, where the first thing you do is you study it and you spend time in analysis. You learn every word and phrase, every note, and all of the nuances that you can imagine. You do a historical study. You learn who it was written by and why it was written and who it was written for. And over all of the years that it's been performed, how did it change? What did it mean a year ago? What did it mean 5 years ago? What did it mean 500 years ago? And after you've learned everything that you can imagine there is to learn about the script, you practice it. You do it in your body, you build muscle memory, you learn every line. And then the really exciting part is when you show up in a rehearsal room with a group of people who are your collaborators, and you do it together. And you look one another in the eye, you take a deep breath, and you say, I got you. When we go into this together and something goes terribly wrong and you forget all your lines, and I got you. And when you make a choice about the interpretation of the script that I don't understand, I'll go there with you. And when you get overcome with emotion and you fall apart and you cry in the middle of the stage and it's really embarrassing, I'm there, I have your back. And you build something together with your minds and with your souls and with your bodies that you couldn't have made by yourself. So I'd like to invite us, as we take communion together, to perform it, because it's a remembrance that is an act that we do. It's physical, just like Jesus would have taken the Passover meal to remember being a slave, escaping from Egypt, running with bread that they didn't have time to let rise. A nobody people fleeing from the Israelites. They remember that by doing it together, by eating the meal in the same room. I invite us to walk inside of the script that we've learned together as we eat the meal together. Person of Jesus, who took bread on the night that he was betrayed, surrounded by the people who he loved who had betrayed him and abandoned him, and he broke it. He said, this is my body, this is my very self that I've broken for you. Eat it in remembrance of me. And this is my blood of the new covenant, which is poured out for you. Let us remember as we do this together. This is the body of Christ, which is broken for you. This is the blood of Christ, which is poured out for you.